It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. After more than a dozen years of planning and construction, a high-voltage transmission line linking Iowa and Wisconsin is complete and operational.
Supporters of the Cardinal Hickory Creek Transmission Line and its utility company owners say it will bring capacity and reliability to the electric grid in the Midwest and provide lower-cost renewable energy.
But some environmental groups had challenged the construction of this transmission line for years, especially as it crosses a sensitive habitat in a national wildlife refuge.
Here to talk about the completion of the Cardinal Hickory Creek Transmission Line is Beth Soholt, Executive Director of the St. Paul-based Clean Grid Alliance, her nonprofit organization advocating for this energy project. Beth, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Good morning. The transmission line has been called by its co-owners the, quote, essential bridge that enables renewable energy to be brought to market. With the line now energized, how pivotal is this moment in the Midwest transition away from fossil fuels?
Yes, it's very pivotal. This line was definitely needed. You know, it was approved in 2011 and energized in 2024. So 13 years to come to completion. And if we're going to really transition away from fossil fuels and meet our sustainability and clean energy goals that communities, states, utilities, corporations have, we are going to need to speed it up when we construct our transmission grid.
It's been said by the utility co-owners of this transmission line that clean energy sources and projects that they were backlogged due to a lack of transmission capacity. Can you speak to what you know of this backlog and the circumstances now with the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line online, so to speak?
Sure. You bet. So when you think about our transmission grid, it's like a big network. Think about the highway system. We've got on-ramps to interstates. We've got interstate lines that run across the country. Transmission is kind of similar. We have different voltage levels that allow power to flow freely back and forth. Power doesn't stop at the border of a state. And so we need to move the energy and the electrons to where they're needed when they're needed. So there were many renewable energy projects that were waiting to be able to deliver all of their energy. Many of them were being curtailed. And so their output, you know, was less than 100%. With this transmission line, there will be the capability to fully deliver the renewable energy from wind, solar, and storage projects in the Midwest.
And you mentioned that there were 160 renewable generation projects that were dependent on this transmission line to be completed. So how will that work? Will they get dedicated space on the line, or will they still be competing with the fossil fuel energy inputs?
Right. So transmission lines are what we call an open access carrier. There is no kind of reserving space on the lines. But, you know, given that we are only constructing, for the most part, renewable energy projects, it's more likely than not that renewable energy will flow on this line. We are, you know, utilities are taking a hard look at economics of fossil plants and shutting those down and reusing the what we call interconnection rights to actually hook up new wind and solar projects. So our grid is getting cleaner. Utilities are investing in renewable energy, and the transmission lines are what allow the energy to flow to homes and businesses.
So what I'm hearing is that even though it's an open access line carrying whatever is on the electricity grid at that moment, it will still advance renewables as we see projects really ramping up here and, you know, fossil fuel plants shutting down.
Yes, we're not building new coal plants. You know, there are processes at the state level to have discussions about that. But, you know, I think utilities have turned the corner on new coal plants. We're still, of course, talking about how much new natural gas, if any, we need, but renewables are definitely the choice of the day. We are adding lots, hundreds and hundreds of megawatts of renewable energy, and we cannot do that without additional transmission capacity like Cardinal Hickory Creek brings to the region.
So this line was litigated by environmental groups along the way. And in March, the Driftless Area Land Conservancy sued to stop construction. The attorney who represented the conservancy, Howard Lerner, told WPR that construction should not have proceeded until the legal case resolved.
The transmission companies, in the meantime, are trying to rush and build, build, build before there can be meaningful judicial review. And it's time that the transmission companies hit the pause button and stop creating more damage where it need not occur.
What is your message to groups that tried to stop construction because this transmission line does cross sensitive natural areas?
Yes. So Clean Grid Alliance has been in this transmission line case since the very beginning. And, I think it starts with just a fundamental disagreement about how we're going to power our future. A lot of folks want very local rooftop solar, community solar projects. I think what people don't realize is that even those types of projects need grid to be able to still deliver their energy. I have good things to say about what the transmission line owners of Cardinal Hickory Creek did to get through the wildlife refuge. I think that if you're a purist, you probably say nothing should go there. But the fact of the matter is, people want more electricity. We are electrifying our homes and businesses, and we have to do responsible transmission line development. And in Clean Grid Alliance's opinion, the utilities did a good job of reducing the number of structures that went through the refuge, doing responsible development, during appropriate seasons, doing a land exchange with the federal government so that, significant acres will be restored. And so we just have to make some of these tough choices. And I think in the Conservancy's mind, it's just no to everything. I don't think we can power our economy with renewable energy going forward with that kind of thought.
We're talking about the newly operational Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line between Dane County and Dubuque. Beth Soholt is here, Executive Director of Clean Grid Alliance. Beth, now that this transmission line is fully operational, what will the Clean Grid Alliance focus its efforts on with policy in this line?
Yes, great question. So, there are more transmission lines in the planning process for the entire region. We work in the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator footprint, which is 15 states in the upper Midwest, kind of going from Canada clear down to Louisiana, and everywhere from, North and South Dakota over to Indiana and Ohio border. So it's a very large area. We have excellent renewable energy resources. Utilities are building a lot of renewables. I noticed that Wisconsin Public Service and We Energies just announced, 500 megawatts of solar, 180 megawatts of wind, 100 megawatts of storage yesterday. And so we will continue to work in the planning process. But I do want to say that we are working very hard with clean energy and environmental advocacy groups in MISO, in the MISO process, to do responsible transmission development. We want the utilities to use the existing grid better before we build new lines. We want to do all the energy efficiency we can before we build new generation. And so it is really a basket of options and tools that we are using to transition our energy system to a clean energy system.
And Beth, the Midwest Regional Grid Operator, MISO, you're talking about their long-range transmission plan, including 18 transmission lines in the Midwest sub-region. This is over $10 billion in planning. Do you anticipate more disputes over the building of transmission lines in the Midwest?
Well, it probably would be silly to say no. They are large infrastructure projects, and they have to be sited somewhere. I think what's not disputed is that we need more grid. We need more transmission capacity. Again, we advocate that we need to use the system we have better before we build new lines. But really, transmission lines are a long-term project. It can take 7 to 10 plus years. You can see this one took 13 years. So if we're really going to meet our 2035, our 2040 goals, or 2050, we have to start planning today. We can do it smartly. We can make sure that there is the least impact possible. But the reality is that we will be constructing more transmission infrastructure.
And very quickly here, the Cardinal Hickory Creek line was over budget. Will that impact ratepayers?
Well, I will let the utility speak to that, but I will just point out that Mr. Lerner had something to do with the project being over budget. Litigating the project for, you know, 5-7 years adds to the cost. Costs go up to meet that extended in-service line. Material costs go up. I'm sure there was a significant amount of money spent on the legal case, and that is still going on. And so they have to take some responsibility for the cost overrun.
Beth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Beth Soholt is Executive Director of the Clean Grid Alliance. It's a nonprofit working to advance renewable energy in the Midwest and a supporter of the Cardinal Hickory Creek Transmission Line project that is now in service, linking Iowa with Wisconsin.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the Wisconsin Technical College System enrolls hundreds of thousands of students each year. We talk with a new president about her vision.
Our goal is always expanding access. We want to do whatever we can to support college attainment across the state, whatever that looks like.
That conversation coming up here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin Technical College System has a new president for the first time in more than a decade.
Layla Merrifield's appointment started last month, overseeing the state's 16 technical colleges.
Together, those colleges enroll hundreds of thousands of students a year and award over 26,000 academic credentials annually.
To weigh in on some issues in Wisconsin higher ed, Layla Merrifield joins us. Layla, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
You're stepping into this role as president, replacing Morna Foy, who had announced her retirement earlier this year after 12 years on the job. What are your initial priorities as you set out and you begin your tenure as president?
My priorities are really to continue the momentum that we've built in the technical college system. We have a lot of positive growth happening all around the state. We, as you know, we are primarily focused on technical and occupational education, and we are certainly finding that even in a relatively tight labor market, there is solid demand for the programming that that we offer, and we'll continue to work with our employers and our communities to make sure that we're offering the appropriate skills education where they need it and in a format that's accessible.
Solid demand, although enrollment across the technical college system-wide has steadily declined over the last decade. So what is going on there? What do you see?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind that a decade ago, we were still coming out of the depths of the Great Recession when we saw just record demand. We were holding classes in closets and in hallways at that point. So our capacity was really stretched thin, given the layoffs that we saw really throughout our economy during that recession. And then, of course, COVID had a profound impact on higher education. So we did see a significant drop in 2020-21 in our enrollments. But I'm happy to say that in the 3 years since FY21, we've seen growth every year. So certainly, we would like to see a little bit higher enrollment, and at least anecdotally, this fall, our numbers are looking really strong. So I hope to see another year of growth.
What are the barriers for students not enrolling in technical colleges?
Gosh, our students, because we are open access, we serve so many different populations of students. It really varies tremendously. We've seen explosive growth in our high school enrollments through dual enrollment. We're over 62,000 high school students served in the most recent year, which has tripled in the last 10 years, I think. So sustaining that growth is a challenge. We saw a huge drop off during COVID of our incarcerated population enrollments. So we continue to try to build back and provide access for those folks who often need adult education and are really looking to get their high school diplomas and high school equivalencies and then hopefully move on to post-secondary work. We're seeing growth in our English language learner populations as we see refugee resettlements throughout Wisconsin. That's very local. Our technical diplomas and applied associate degrees, though, are holding steady in terms of enrollment. We see solid demand there. I think our students are really looking at the opportunity cost of going to college right now. When, again, the labor market is so strong and we're seeing solid wage growth in Wisconsin, it just raises that opportunity cost. I think we're also challenged with childcare in this state. We lost around 30% of our childcare providers during COVID. I think that's a real challenge for our working families to try to find alternative care for their kids so that they can spend time in class. We'll continue to try to find solutions for those working adults and make sure they understand that we have a wide range of wraparound support services that are waiting to help them.
I want to hone in a little bit on that opportunity cost. In your biennial budget initiative, it says that the median debt for a technical college student graduate in Wisconsin is $10,130. Is there anything that can be done to reduce that debt and limit financial hardship?
Absolutely. We're requesting in our budget request additional need-based financial aid via the Wisconsin Grant Program. I think that's an important piece. We anticipate having a wait list for the first time in several years for that program. So that's an important help for students who have financial barriers. We're seeing hopefully a little bit of a maximum Pell Grant increase this year at the federal level. If Congress authorizes that, they're contemplating a $100 increase. We would love to see that, even at the margins, that can really help students. Something else that we're working on in the technical college system is developing additional open educational resources. We received a $3 million grant in the last state budget to develop free textbooks that are written and maintained by our faculty and are provided to students at no cost, whether they're enrolled in our colleges or even at other colleges. They're developed with taxpayer funds and they're available to everyone. So we continue to try to think creatively about how to hold down the cost of higher education. And of course, our system board has a longstanding policy of trying to keep our tuition increases pretty minimal from year to year. We really try to hold down the cost as much as we possibly can for both students and taxpayers.
We're discussing Wisconsin's 16 technical colleges with Layla Merrifield, the new president of the Wisconsin Technical College System. I want to turn to this award from Delta Dental of Wisconsin. Its foundation recently donated money to help create 9 new dental hygienist, dental assistant, and dental therapy programs, expand other existing programs in this area of oral health. What impact will this have on dental care in Wisconsin?
Well, the impact is going to be massive once it's fully implemented. We were really pleased to partner with the Wisconsin Dental Association and the governor and legislature in the last budget cycle. We were allocated $20 million that was really aimed at capital costs to expand the size of our dental labs and clinics on our campuses. Operatories and chairs are just an incredibly expensive endeavor to install and to maintain. So that's going to help us add chairs in the labs, and then we will be challenged to reallocate our operating funds to make sure that we have sufficient faculty who are available to teach those courses. Often those are working or retired dentists who we need to supervise those hygiene courses. But we anticipate over 200 additional credentials every single year will be generated once all of those programs are online. And if you sort of multiply that out to the number of patients that a dental hygienist or a dental assistant can impact in a year, we think it's going to make a real difference for particularly Medicaid patients and our rural populations who often have severe dental workforce shortages in especially our northern counties. As you mentioned, Delta Dental Foundation covered the matching funds that were required of our colleges. Mm-hmm. That frees up local funds that we can put into these operating costs to expand these labs and cohorts.
The legislature created a study committee on the future of the UW system that met over the summer. And in July, someone who serves on that committee said the relationship between the system's 2-year campuses and the state's technical colleges should be reconsidered. What is this relationship like to you?
Well, you know, we're often in the same communities, right? And so we have worked over time to collaborate as much as was appropriate and made sense for both sides. So an example that always comes to mind is Marinette. You know, there's a UW Marinette campus that's now part of UW Green Bay. And in Marinette, we have Northeast Wisconsin Technical College has a small campus. And of course, they do quite a lot of work with Marinette Fincantieri Marine up there. But they also have a campus with some pretty good science labs. And so for a long time, UW Marinette was having their sort of chemistry courses hosted at NWTC, and that made sense for both sides. So there are some opportunities along those lines, but I think, you know, moving forward, you know, I'm looking at models such as the one that's being developed between Waukesha County Technical College and UW-Milwaukee to offer bachelor's completion on the campus of WCTC as UW has decided to exit the UW-Waukesha campus. We want to make sure that Waukesha County has the access to UW-Milwaukee going forward, and we're certainly happy to partner and try to make that a positive development for the community. And again, you know, our goal is always expanding access. And UW is obviously our biggest transfer partner, and we want to do whatever we can to support college attainment across the state, whatever that looks like.
So really filling academic gaps when they emerge or when they occur.
Yeah, and finding ways to serve the community. You know, it's all very local. It's very regional. And so we try to listen to our communities and respond and bring them what they need to the greatest extent possible.
I want to land on DEI, Wisconsin Technical College System. Its board president, Mark Tyler, boasted that the state's tech colleges have a student population more racially diverse than the state's demographics overall. What are your views on DEI in the system?
Yeah, well, again, I'll reference our employers who tell us that a stronger workforce is a more diverse workforce. Many of our local chambers of commerce and our individual employers, some of our largest employers in the state, continue to talk about DEI as a workforce imperative. And we view it similarly. In the Wisconsin Technical College system, we've always been an open access system, and we've always had a huge diversity of learners from different racial backgrounds. And as you say, our populations are higher than the state's minority population overall. We disproportionately serve more first-generation students. We disproportionately serve more students who have academic challenges, who have financial barriers. And it's part of our statutory mission to really address those barriers head on and prioritize non-traditional occupations and to make sure that the Wisconsin workforce has equal access to the opportunities that are available in the labor market. So, we continue to think about how we can best serve diverse populations throughout the state, no matter the challenges, no matter the barriers. A personal passion of mine is to implement more universal design for learning principles in everything that we do in our classrooms and in our workplaces, and make sure that we are a welcoming place for folks with neurodivergent learning styles. I think that's something that younger generations are becoming much more aware of and are really breaking down the stigma around that. And for me personally, I would really like technical colleges to be known as neuro-inclusive places to work and to learn.
President Merrifield, thank you for the conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Layla Merrifield is the new president of the Wisconsin Technical College System.
Now, the Brewers are back in the playoffs as division champions. Bally Sports announcer Jeff Levering talked to WPR's Alex Crow about the team's chances this fall.
Alrighty, let's go ahead and start with the pitching, because that was a big question mark coming into this season, especially with a couple of key losses with Corbin Burns and Brandon Woodruff. So tell me, how has the pitching worked out so far this season for the Brewers to be where they're at right now?
Yeah, it's been a real work in progress. Not a lot of teams go through 17 different starting pitchers and 12 different guys that have picked up saves over the course of a season and been a successful team. But the Brewers have certainly turned into a very successful team. And it really took a trade to get Frankie Montas into this organization in August to really solidify things. So really for the last 2 months, it's been a pretty normal pitching rotation. The guys in the bullpen have been relatively interchangeable, with the exception of a few guys, a few mainstays at the back end of that bullpen. And now that Devin Williams is back, it's really rock solid back there.
The Brewers have had a lot of offensive success as well. You have guys like Willy Adames and Jackson Churio, now members of the 2020 club. How has the offense been able to help the team so far this year?
I think it's been a really dynamic style of offense. And they just go out there and they have long at-bats and they draw their walks and they push guys forward and they're running a lot and they're successful hitting with runners in scoring position. They lead the league and two out runs scored. It's just a different brand of offense. And for me, it's a throwback kind of to the 80s, where you would run and hit behind runners and drive a guy in. It was the old adage of get a guy on, get him over, get him in. And that's what the Brewers have been doing over the course of the year. Yeah, they'll hit their homers. It's been really a more dynamic style of offense and one that is almost slump proof. And you could tell that by the Brewers not losing more than three games over the course of the season. And they have not lost more than three games in a row all season long.
It's kind of hard for the Brewers to imagine continuity, or at least their fans, because it seemed in the offseason like that might not be a thing. We already talked about the changes to the pitching staff that was going to be happening, not to mention the coaching staff with Craig Counsell leaving and Pat Murphy jumping in. Talk a little bit about that continuity for the Brewers and how Pat Murphy's been able to really rise to the occasion this season managing this club.
My biggest takeaway is that the only piece that left was Craig. Everybody else stayed from last year. The coaching staff that had been here during the stretch where the Brewers have made the postseason six of the last 7 years, it's those guys that have the consistent message. And Murph's been here the entire time. Yeah, he didn't have the main voice that Craig did as the manager because he was the bench coach, but he's been here. You go from being the vice principal or the substitute teacher to being the principal. It's a different voice, but for Murph, he's always been the same. And I think Murph and the rest of this coaching staff has done a brilliant job of keeping everybody connected.
All right, Jeff, last question for you. Our very own WPR's Evan Casey here is a huge Brewers fan, and he told me when I asked if he had any questions for you to ask about the team's motto this year, which is apparently undaunted. What does that mean? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, the undaunted, and you hear relentless a lot. Those are the two big key phrases with this organization. And you know, it goes back to what we were just talking about with all these different negative things that happen over the course of a season. You can really get caught in some of that. And just to be undaunted for Pat Murphy, and it goes back to his dad in his playing days in a football game where he was making a play going around the right end. And the newspaper writer said that Pat Murphy's dad was undaunted in his way to get to the outside. That's where the whole thing stems from. But it's just this who cares mentality. It's us against the world. Don't worry about the little stuff because as a team, we're going to get it done. Once you come through those clubhouse doors, it's all about winning that night. It's all about winning for your teammates. It's all about being there for each other. It's not about the other stuff that's happening. And believe me, everybody deals with a lot of stuff outside of baseball. But as soon as you go through those clubhouse doors, or for me, the broadcast booth doors, it's all about winning that day.
And that was Jeff Levering. He's a play-by-play announcer for the Brewers on Bally Sports Wisconsin. He talked with WPR Morning Edition host Alex Crow.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a Day of the Dead celebration in the Driftless region will feature an altar built collectively by the community.
We will honor this year to the agriculture and all the food workers.
Dia de los Muertos and traditions in Mexican art coming up on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in the middle of National Hispanic Heritage Month. And here in Wisconsin, a Dia de Muertos celebration will bring together community members in the Driftless region to remember loved ones who have died.
Day of the Dead is one of the most important traditions in Mexico, and it's a joyful celebration. The event at Cueden Farms in Viola will feature a collective ofrenda, or altar, to honor people who worked in the food economy.
Gabriela Jimenez Marvan is an artist in Viroqua and founder of the Mexican Folk Art Collective. She will help lead the community ofrenda at the Dia de Muertos celebration on Saturday and is also debuting Wisconsin's first life-size Alebrije monument at the Farm Art Detour during Fermentation Fest in Sauk City. Gabriela, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, Kay. Thank you for the invitation, and I appreciate Wisconsin Arbors to make this connection with Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yes. Can you introduce us to the Mexican Folk Art Collective, and what inspired you to create it?
Yeah, well, I moved here to the United States in 2019, so I studied like this traditional technique from Mexico. It's called cartoneria, and it's a very root artisanal technique that we use in a lot of festivities. So when I arrived here in the United States, I didn't have a job like all the migrants who come here and then starting over, right? Mm. So I started doing just what I loved and what I knew how to do it. Those are like piñatas or like paper mache sculptures or called cartoneria. But I was feeling that lack of community, like connection of my community, you know, like in Mexico, I was part of a collective in there and also a co-founder.
I would imagine you felt inspiration to be around other artists, and it might have felt a bit lonely and not as much inspiration when you first came to Wisconsin. Has that changed at all? Has that community changed?
Yeah, absolutely. With the Mexican Folk Art Collective, we started being 10 artists. And because I didn't know a lot of people here in the United States, I connected my friend from Mexico, who are like different techniques artisans. Like they do pottery, textiles, and fashion designers, and like different expressions. So also the pandemic was a reason why. A lot of places closed, so we needed to expose our work. And then we started being 10 artists, just two from United States and the rest were from Mexico. And we did this collective community, virtual community, where we were like offering conversations and talks about our art, about the cultural meaning of what we do. Hmm. And then now we are 25 artists, and mostly the half of them, we are like now living in the United States. And some of them are like second generation, so they are Mexican American. And the purpose of this is to share our culture through our art, because like most of them, well, all of us base our art in our traditions or our roots and our identity. We love to share. We love the curiosity that some people has when we have exhibitions or workshops or community events, and they are curious to know more about Mexican culture, and we feel very, very proud, and it's something that we have lived in since we were children.
Yeah. Gabriela, I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of a tour around your studio and introduce us to your technique, cartoneria. Is that right? Cartoneria?
Yeah. Cartoneria comes from the word carton. It means cardboard. So I do sculptures. There is no word in English, but people said here is paper mache. I work with natural reeds like wood or structure for the big sculptures. Like I'm telling you, like real size sculptures. Till now, I am doing big sculptures like more than 12 feet.
Wow, more than 12 feet.
Yes.
So you have to get on a ladder in order to work with these sculptures.
Yes, ladder, scaffolding. It's kind of a mural, but in 3D. This sculpture is very special because it is an alebrije, and the alebrije is part of the icons of the Mexican folk art. And we participate in the Warm Farm Institute, the event they organize. That is Art Detour coming in October 5th till the 14th. Mm-hmm. We are collaborating between Ryan Rottweiler, who is my husband, and also Leonardo Linares, who live in Mexico City, and he is part of the traditional cartoneros. His grandfather was the creator of the alebrijes.
You mean Pedro Linares?
Yes,
wow.
You know.
Wow.
Yes. Pedro Linares created the alebrijes in 1930s. So then Leonardo is his grandson, and he is also part of the Mexican Folk Art Collective. And he is also collaborating with us, like remote. The design is based on a sketch that he did. And we are building it in 3D, and now we are painting it. We are in the stage of painting this.
I'm so curious, whether is it a creature? Is it an animal? What is it?
An alebrije is a mixture between two or more animals. So this one is going to be a mixture between a rooster, a lizard, and a bird, and a tail of a fish.
Yeah. You're throwing everything in there. What are the colors? Talk about the colors.
We are still in the process of putting the base colors, but those are vibrant colors and contrasting. We are using yellow, purple, aqua, and but all are like vibrant colors because that's kind of the style of the alebrijes. And we're going to put like patterns, different patterns, like a scale. Like feathers or scales through all the surface.
Wow, it will be monumental.
It is monumental. And people can go and see, and it's going to be in Sauk City for 10 days.
Yeah. We're talking about Mexican folk art in Wisconsin with Gabriela Jimenez-Marvan, an artist in Viroqua who founded the Mexican Folk Art Collective. Gabriela, how do alebrijes embrace Mexican independence and a distinctively Mexican folk art?
Well, alebrijes, as other things, are icons now from the Mexican folk art. It's like talking about alebrijes is about talking, I don't know, like mariachis or something that represents Mexico. It makes me feel connected to my identity and also to the people who see this. Now I think like international have been like more and more known, the alebrijes, and I wish more people know about them and sharing the story and the meaning of them. It feels good to share this meaning. You just feel that a way to share the culture is a way to understand other cultures and to be more empathetic to other people's culture than.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep the tradition going to the next generation and keep what you know how to do and your techniques carrying that on?
Well, we organize as a collective. We organize events or workshops. And one event that we are organizing, and it's one our main event in the year, is the Dia de Muertos, coming also in October 5th. And we started doing this in 2021. This is our fourth year. We wanted just to find like a place where to do it and sharing in a way the traditional one. I met Joy and Rufus from Kiwaiting Farms, who also has like an organization called Driftless Curiosity, and they offer us to do it in their land. So they open their doors, their farm to the people. And this year we planted 5,000 cempasúchiles. That's the word in Nahuatl, but it's marigolds.
5,000. Oh my.
Yes. Yeah. It's so beautiful. I cannot describe in words the feeling of that you feel when you arrive to that place and start smelling since you are arriving in your car. And while we are like building, we don't build like before the ofrenda or the altar to the people to see. We want to build it together with the community.
So, it's a collective ofrenda. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. It's a collective ofrenda.
Who will it honor?
We will honor this year to the agriculture and all the food workers. Every year, you know, a collective ofrenda is offered to someone. The first year we offered, it was 2021, so we offered to the victims of COVID. And then the second year we offered to the activists, environmental activists, who have protected this planet. And then we offered last year to the woman who have been victims of femicide.
Oh.
And this year we offered to the workers on food. So for food, there are going to be 6 different businesses. And 2 more food vendors who are going to prepare traditional meals, because that's what it's about, the Dia de Muertos, no? To share the meals with our loved one who has passed away. So we are going to remember through what they used to like. So we're preparing mole and arroz and chocolate or, café de olla. I'm just hungry when I'm telling you.
Yes, so many delicious things. And with an ofrenda, sometimes you'll see pictures, photos of the person who is being honored. Since this is a community ofrenda, How will you work with that?
Well, we put some photos, but also we invite people to bring their own photos of their families if they want to share it. So people feel this. Have some comments of the people in the past. It has been that they feel this event like a healing moment.
Yeah.
Because the feeling of losing someone is universal, no? It's not only of our cultures. So this is a very touchy moment, exactly when people participate in the ofrenda and they say that they finally are able to talk about it, talk about the dead like part of the life. Mm. So it's about healing for a lot of people and also to reconnect to the new generations to live this tradition, but also to the migrants who have long, long time ago not gone to Mexico. They have shared their feelings that reconnecting with their identity through this. So this is very special for Mexicans, Mexican-American, but also for all the United States culture to know more about the tradition and the meaning of each element we put in the ofrenda.
Yes. Gabriela, when you think about the future of Mexican folk arts here in Wisconsin, what are things that could help it flourish and help it unite people and help it heal?
Oh, well, I find like the way to grow is through the workshops, or through the community event that more and more people know about it and the new generations know about it and their parents help them or connect their daughters, their sons to their own identity, no? Mm. And also there is a grant that I got through the Wisconsin Art Boards that it's a apprenticeship program that I find this opportunity very helpful where I am teaching the technique of cartoneria. So they are learning and they are going to be presenting the October 5th dress, like elements on cartoneria of a real person dress, like a Katrina. So Katrina is the skeleton lady with mm-hmm. dress.
Okay.
You have seen it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So one of the apprentices is going to be the Katrina wearing her own dress that she designed. So that's really cool. And another artist from Mexico who is also part of the collective, she's designing the dress. So she's a fashion designer and we are making a collaboration. So I find in the collective, we always try to make this kind of collaboration and not like forcing them, but if that could happen, we can make it happen, no?
Oh, it's a beautiful synergy. Oh, so wonderful. Gabriela, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ki.
Gabriela Jimenez-Marvan is an artist in Viroqua and the founder of the Mexican Folk Art Collective. We've been talking about Mexican folk art projects in Wisconsin and upcoming events during National Hispanic Heritage Month that's underway.
Wisconsin plays host once again to the World Dairy Expo kicking off today. And as people from around the world gather in Madison, we want to hear from you.
Are you involved in any aspect of the dairy business as a dairy farmer or farm worker, maybe in dairy processing or delivery, or perhaps in a school nutrition program?
Tell us about the work you do and some of the challenges you're seeing.
Leave us a message. You can text us right now at 888-642-0232. You can also find that number at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today, where you can text us as well.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.